I never imagined I'd be thinking about sororities this much after college. It's not because I'm attending alumni events or wearing my Greek letters around New York. It's because of this podcast. A few weeks ago, I did an episode about sorority consultants, women who charge serious money to help freshmen survive the sorority recruitment process. I talked to two of them, I interviewed a student who'd just gone through the rush process herself, and I watched the Bama Rush documentary more times than I'd care to admit. And somewhere in the middle of all that reporting, I had a weird realization. I'd been in a sorority, I was reporting on sororities, and still, I knew almost nothing about where they came from or why they started. And it turns out there's a reason for that.
You look at the histories of women's higher education, and there's almost no mention of sororities.
I'm Margot Gray. This week on Campus Files, the history of American sororities and why you won't find it anywhere in our history books.
I purposely went to a college that didn't have sororities. It just wasn't interesting to me.
This is NYU professor Diana Turk. She's the author of Bound by a Mighty Vow, Sisterhood and Women's Fraternities.
If you had asked me if I was ever going to write a book about sororities when I was in college, I would have said there's no chance.
Diana did not go to grad school planning to study sororities. Her plan was political science. But then she got there, and suddenly she was surrounded by something she hadn't really encountered before, Greek life. Her undergraduate school, Hamilton College, hadn't even had sororities, and now they were everywhere.
This was brand new to me, this idea that people would walk around in this kind of large state university with letters on. I was just really curious.
Like many grad students, Diana was teaching a class of undergraduates in her spare time. A lot of those students were in Greek life. And one afternoon, a student stayed after class. She was in a sorority.
She came to me and said, "I've got a bunch of sorority sisters taking your class. Let me know if they don't do well, if they're not working hard for you." And I thought, isn't that interesting? Like this idea that it mattered to them that the people who also wore their same letters did well.
The more Diana watched these women in class around campus, the more she wanted to understand them. That curiosity led her somewhere she didn't expect. She left political science, switched into anthropology, and made sororities the subject of her dissertation, which meant she was committing to more than just reading about sororities. Anthropology is immersive. You embed yourself in a community. For Diana, that meant spending a lot of time with sorority women.
I did formal interviews, but a lot of the time I was just hanging out, looking around, observing, and sort of taking field notes and gathering data.
Diana was doing this research in places you wouldn't necessarily expect for a grad student. She did most of her field work in sorority houses. And she also spent a lot of time at the VU, the campus bar most popular with students in Greek life. But eventually, she had to do some traditional research.
I remember this so clearly. I went up to the library thinking I was doing, you know, background research. That was going to be chapter one. And I'm looking and there's like nothing there. I mean, you'd have these like 400 page histories of women's higher ed, and there's almost no mention of sororities.
At first, Diana assumed she was just looking in the wrong place. Surely she was missing something. She pulled every book off the shelf that could have conceivably mentioned sororities. She read the footnotes, followed citations, nothing. So she widened the search. She went looking in other libraries, the University of Illinois, University of Wisconsin, Swarthmore, even the Library of Congress. Still nothing.
So I went back to my department and we had a very prominent women's historian. She was the one who said to me, "I really think you have a topic here. And I would like you to switch out of the sort of anthropology track into the women's history track."
Switching to women's history meant starting over an additional year of graduate school. But the historian encouraged Diana to make the switch because nobody had done this research before. Diana's peers, on the other hand, were less enthusiastic.
The first day, everybody goes around, says what they study. And I would say, yeah, you know, I'm studying historically white Christian sororities. And you can imagine what the reaction was, because other feminist scholars could not understand how you could be a feminist historian and study sororities.
Diana's classmates weren't just dismissive of the topic. They warned her that she'd never get grants, that she'd struggle to find a job in academia. Diana wasn't discouraged. What worried her more was this. There was almost nothing written by historians about sororities, which meant there was only one place left to look, the sororities themselves. Many sororities keep extensive archives at their national headquarters, letters, meeting minutes, internal memos, but they don't just welcome outsiders to come read those materials. Quite the opposite.
Sororities would constantly say, why are you interested in this? Like, why do you need our archives? And I said to them, if I just want to write a negative story about sororities, I don't need to do any research.
Eventually, one sorority reluctantly agreed to let Diana visit its archives, Kappa Alpha Theta, the oldest sorority in the country. But this wasn't a come on in, make yourself at home situation.
Early on, Theta was very guarded. Every time I went to the archives, I sat next to Mary Edith Arnold, who was at the time their amazing archivist. And she was a professional archivist at Motorola and had brought these incredible skills kind of in retirement to doing it at Theta.
Mary Edith Arnold controlled what information Diana was allowed to see and what information she wasn't.
Maybe the second day, I went to get tea. I come back and she's looked at my notes. And she said to me, we have a problem. She said, you have our password.
Mary was referring to the sorority password. Almost every sorority has one. A word or phrase that's revealed during initiation. Only sorority members are supposed to know it.
And I was like, okay. You know, like, I didn't realize that's something I copied down from some handwritten note from a meeting in 1870, that is still the password. And I said, I'm not here to expose secrets. I said, to me, what's interesting is that you have a password and that the password has been the same since 1870. That's the interesting thing. And so we agreed early that there was no expose involved.
Diana made multiple trips to visit the Kappa Alpha Theta archives. Each time, she'd stay for about a week. There was actually a room with beds next door to the archives.
And so, you know, it's this room that's called the dormer. You know, it's like a bunch of beds and I'm sleeping there. Mary Edith is sleeping, you know, a few beds next to me. And we're getting meals together and things like that.
The more time they spent together, the more Mary began to trust her.
Over time, I was given more and more access till finally it was just, here's the key, come and go. And by the end, they were shipping me boxes. This is before anything was digitized. They were shipping me boxes of materials and saying, dig through this as you will. And once Theta trusted me, the other organizations were much more open. And I ended up spending time in people's houses, interviewing some of the kind of senior leaders of the organizations.
Diana lived and breathed sorority history. And the deeper she went, the more convinced she became that her peers in the women's history department had it wrong. Sororities weren't a footnote. She learned that you can't tell the story of women's higher education without them. In 1837, Oberlin College did something radical. It admitted women. For the first time in the country's history, women attended college alongside men. But co-education didn't exactly sweep the nation. It spread slowly, very slowly. 30 years later, most colleges still didn't admit women at all. There were five times as many men enrolled in higher education as there were women. So for the women who were allowed in, they were vastly outnumbered. And they weren't exactly made to feel welcome. professors were often the most vocal opponents. Some professors, to make female students feel out of place, deliberately addressed them as Mr.
In a lot of cases, there's campus newspaper articles publishing, you know, sort of scathing reviews of them, and they're being called unwomanly. In some places, they're made to sit in the back.
This was the climate 30 years later at Asbury College, a small school in Indiana. They decided to admit women for the first time, four of them. It did not go well. A male student complained in the paper that neither Yale nor Harvard nor any other first-class institution in the country had embraced coeducation. He argued that letting women in would lower Asbury's standing. This kind of commentary in the student paper became so hostile that administrators eventually banned attacks on the women. But that didn't change the atmosphere on campus. So one of the four women, Betty Locke, proposed something practical. What if the women formed a society of their own, not just for companionship, but for academic discipline? A way to hold each other to high standards, to prove the men wrong, and demonstrate that women could excel. In January 1870, the four women did just that. They founded the country's first Greek letter sorority, Kappa Alpha Theta. They modeled it off of men's fraternities, the Greek letters, the initiation ceremonies. But the purpose was totally different.
Their real concern is promoting female scholarship and showing that women can do higher education. They spend their meetings examining each other. Before anybody is going to present in class, they must present in front of each other and get what they call criticisms and feedback. They fine each other if they don't try out their academic work first.
Those fines were real. If a woman failed to present a speech or presentation to the group beforehand, she paid. It was the sorority's way of enforcing standards, making sure no one walked into the classroom unprepared. And those standards didn't just apply to current students. They shaped who got invited into the sorority.
If they have concerns about any of the new students, they work with them and say, you know, we're just waiting for you to raise your grades. And once you raise your grades, then we're very interested in you as a member. But they will not initiate somebody whose grades aren't strong. They will not take in somebody who's not going to show that women can be, not just do higher ed, but be really successful.
In those early years, members of Kappa Alpha Theta consistently finished at the top of their class. Many became valedictorians. They were doing exactly what they'd set out to do. And still, they faced criticism. Critics simply changed their argument. Maybe women can handle the academics, but college is making them unwomanly. This was the central claim of a widely read 1873 book called A Fair Chance for Girls. Its author was a prominent physician.
And he argues that if women study, the blood is going to go to their brains and not their ovaries, and that their reproductive systems are going to shrivel up. And he even tells stories of people dying from their studies. They become so weak and they become so frail that they die. If you can imagine being one of these five women on campus where this major professor has published this book, that would have been really hard.
Now it wasn't enough for women to prove they could keep up academically. They also had to prove they could do it without sacrificing their femininity. So sororities evolved. They became training grounds, not just for scholarship, but for womanhood. This is when we first see sororities enforcing a very specific idea of what a woman should be. Sorority members started practicing hosting, which fork to use, which chafing dish was appropriate for which occasion. They knitted, they wrote poetry.
They really are focused on showing themselves as models of true womanhood. That yes, they are scholars, but they're also models of true womanhood.
This mattered even more as Kappa Alpha Theta began opening chapters on other campuses.
As they begin to spread, the first thing that they do is they begin to write to the deans of students and say, who are your smartest girls? Who are doing well in higher ed? But they're also reaching out to families who are considered the prominent families in town, who are modeling the ways that women are supposed to be acting.
At schools across the country, women followed Kappa Alpha Theta's lead. They formed societies of their own, Delta Gamma, Kappa Kappa Gamma, Pi Beta Phi. And together, these groups became a kind of infrastructure. They supported the first generation of women in higher education, not just while they were in college, but in their lives afterwards.
Many of them go on to work outside the home. Many of them become interested in science or teaching. They really are pushing against the boundaries of what women tend to do.
One of the biggest boundaries they pushed against was travel. At the time, a single woman traveling alone was viewed with suspicion, sometimes accused of prostitution, but not sorority women.
And the reason they're able to do it is because they can come with their sorority pin. They're immediately recognized as part of society. They're welcomed in. They're welcome to church. They're loaned silver. They're loaned linen. They're loaned whatever they need. These stories, and some of them actually like made me tearful, of women who otherwise would have been kind of stuck in their small towns, traveling out west to teach, taking a job where they don't know anybody.
For the founding sorority members, this was the point: to prove that women could handle the intellectual rigor of college, that they could succeed in the workforce, and that they could do all of it without sacrificing their femininity. By the end of the 19th century, that case had largely been made, which raised a new question. If women no longer needed to prove they belonged on campus, what were sororities for? Coeducation happened slowly in the U.S., and then all at once. In 1870, the year the first sorority was founded, about 4,600 women were enrolled in college in the United States. 20 years later, that number had jumped to nearly 40,000. And 30 years after that, 283,000. Women's presence on campus became less novel, less controversial, which meant there was less pressure to constantly prove they belonged, that they could handle the academics. So gradually, the focus inside sororities began to shift. Meetings that once revolved around studying and classwork started to feel different. Remember how in the early days, members could be fined for failing to practice class presentations in front of the group? By the 1890s, that wasn't the case.
Now this group is fining each other if they don't go to enough parties. And you can't miss parties, and you have to go to the certain parties with the certain fraternities, and it becomes much more of a social whirlwind.
And the way they recruited new members changed too. In the early years, recruitment had been a deliberate and slow process.
The women in the first generation are taking at least 6 months to see whose grades are good. The second generation, they're grabbing people off the trains.
That's not an exaggeration. This is actually where we get the term for sorority recruitment, rush.
The whole idea of rush is that they rushed the trains. As the trains would arrive with the new collegians, the sororities rush them and they see who's wearing the prettiest dresses and who's got the most trunks and who's got the most hat boxes. And they're saying, you're mine. They're all fighting over these, what they consider an attractive girl. That's antithetical to how it was founded.
Antithetical because recruitment was no longer centered on academics at all. And the shift wasn't confined to one campus. It was national. And sorority alumni across the country took notice.
So this is where the alumni begin to step in. And they're like, no, this is not how we do things.
Alumni had always been involved in their sororities to some degree, visiting campus, speaking with active members, helping launch chapters at new schools. But they were about to get much more involved. They stepped in to professionalize the operation. In 1902, 8 sororities sent alumni to Chicago to set standards for sororities nationwide. The big focus was rush. No more chaotic scenes at train stations, no more competing for new students the second they arrived on campus. There would be designated rush periods and clear rules. They named it the National Panhellenic Conference, and they met every year to keep refining those standards. Rush was one focus. Membership criteria was another.
They begin to come together and they were like, okay, we are going to start asking for recommendation letters. We're going to have GPA requirements.
So what was the point of all of these requirements? It was to make sure that as sororities grew, as they spread to other campuses, they weren't lowering their standards, that every woman wearing her sorority letters represented the organization well.
They want to educate all members with the same, more standardized narrative of what it means to be a Theta or a Pi Phi or a Tri Delta. And the alumni are doing a lot of that, reminders of you belong to a national organization. You have to remember that everyone is a link in the chain, and one weak link hurts the chain.
At the same time that alumni were working to polish the image of sororities, making sure there were no weak links, something else was happening on campus. College admissions were changing. In the 1910s and 1920s, more Jewish students were gaining access to higher education, more Catholic students too. And that complicated things for sororities, especially ones that had chapters in different parts of the country. Diana told me about one controversy where the Theta sorority at Swarthmore College in Pennsylvania wanted to accept a Jewish woman.
The Thetas who are in other places say, absolutely not. I can't welcome her into my home. I won't welcome her into my home. And so it becomes a question of, it's almost a least common denominator. You can only take people who everybody will welcome.
In some places, exclusionary policies were unspoken. In others, it was spelled out. Diana found one document in which various sorority leaders swapped information on who they excluded and why.
I could not believe this document existed. And they are incredibly honest. I mean, it blew my mind. They're not embarrassed about it. This is fine.
One member didn't mince words. Defending the exclusion of Jewish women, she wrote, "The Jew will never be an American." When Diana read quotes like that, something clicked. It helped explain why historians had quietly left sororities out of the broader history of women's higher education.
For the women who were writing those books at that time, in a lot of cases, they were really celebrating these early generations of women as pioneers. And it becomes complicated when you find out that your pioneer who's breaking down barriers is still really anti-Semitic and racist. That's a complicated narrative.
For Diana, who's Jewish, the whole study was particularly complicated.
I became very, I would say, close personally to a lot of the women who had joined these organizations and were my mother's age. Would they have admitted my mom, who was Jewish? I don't know.
So where do things stand today on the question of exclusion? Greek letter sororities are still overwhelmingly white. Some studies estimate that roughly 4 out of 5 members are white. And if you listened to last season, you might remember that the University of Alabama sorority system didn't integrate until 2013. And even then, it took campus protests and a national media firestorm for a Black woman to finally be accepted. So in a lot of ways, that history still lingers. But in other ways, the sorority experience today would be almost unrecognizable to earlier generations, particularly when it comes to recruitment.
What would the first generations think of Bama Rush? They would be horrified, because so much of the whole Bama Rush and TikTok of Bama Rush is about presenting yourself in a certain way to win membership. And that is so not what the first generation wanted. That's a lot of what Bama Rush is you can hire a consultant and get yourself in.
There may be more emphasis on image than the first generation would have liked. But Diana's quick to point out, the academic focus hasn't entirely disappeared. In many sororities, maintaining a certain GPA can qualify you for scholarships. And if you're struggling in class, there's often a support system in place.
My daughter was the academic chair of her sorority, where she worked with some of the students who were not doing as well and had to talk to them about how she could help support their study habits.
Diana says that kind of support extends beyond academics. Sororities often still function as support networks for women.
I feel like in a lot of the time, the sororities are trying to teach how to rely on your sisters and depend on your sisters, even in a world in which it's still not safe to be female. I think about the sorority women at Columbia who walked around with the mattresses years ago to protest date rape. You know, the first generation, they were ridiculed and overtly called names. It may not be as overt now, but we still live in a male-dominated world.
If you've got a story idea, we would love to hear about it. Send us an email at campusfilespod@gmail.com. And if you're loving this podcast, be sure to click follow on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. While you're there, leave us a review and a 5-star rating. Campus Files is an Odyssey original podcast hosted by Margot Gray and Ian Mont. Our executive producers are Leah Rees-Dennis and Lloyd Lockridge. Campus Files is produced by Ian Mont and Margot Gray. Sound design and engineering by Andy Jaskowitz and Zach Clark. Legal support by Laura Berman and Melissa Jean. Original music by Davey Sumner. Special thanks to Maura Curran, Josephina Francis, Hilary Schuff, Eric Donnelly, Kate Hutchison-Rose, Sean Cherry, Kurt Courtney, and Lauren Vieira.